Previously on Long Lost.
The day the boys went missing, it was November 10th in 1951.
I should have went with them. I know that. I mean, there's no way to get around that.
I'd like to make a plea to all you people to help us find our boys. If you just look everywhere, no matter where it is, they're awful little to beat out the snow.
I don't know what the thought process was on making that conclusion that they went to the river and they drowned in the river when nothing was found. You know, you can't look at a mom who has lost three kids. You can't say no to that. The more I read into it and the more information that my partner and I found, I realized, okay, there's something to what she's saying here. There's something that's just not right.
I'm Jack Elhai, and this is Long Lost, a new investigative history series from Twin Cities PBS. Growing up with this in your family make you feel any different, even if you may not have talked to anybody about it?
Oh, Jack, just growing up with red hair made me feel different. How would you separate the two out? I know it made a difference in my life. I know it affected me. I couldn't name the ways. You know, you've always got a hole in your heart, you know. And when you're young, you don't know what that's about. And as you get older, it starts to settle in that maybe the hole is spot that they should have taken up. That was their spot, and it's vacant. It's empty.
Donald Klein is a friendly man with an expressive and forthright face, living in a corner house within the town limits of Monticello, Minnesota. The house used to belong to his parents. It is crowded with items that evoke Betty and Kenneth, cuckoo clocks on the wall, historical images of Monticello from decades past, lots of older upholstered furniture, boxes of family papers, and photos covering the walls. The house is cluttered with stuff and emotions, a home left in homage to the past, and Donald seems to want to continue his role as the caretaker of the family story. Donald never met his missing brothers. He's the youngest in the Klein family, and he was born 9 years after Kenneth Jr., David, and Danny vanished.
Well, I'm the youngest of my brothers in the family of Kenneth and Elizabeth. I was born 1960, October 19th. I've got a small business now. I'm a truck driver.
Do you remember when you first understood that you had missing brothers?
I probably was about 3 years old, you know, and actually it was always there, but it was about 3 years old, I think, when my grandma took care of us brothers so that mom and dad could go to check out a lead, I would imagine, because ever so often they used to put it in the newspaper that they were looking for their sons. And then, of course, that would generate people sending leads or information, you know, so mom and dad would go check it out.
He's referring to the newspaper ad the family ran for dozens of years on November 10th, the anniversary of the boys' disappearance, the ad I saw in 1997 that got me interested in the case. But Betty and Kenneth Klein did much more than take out ads. They also pleaded for help from the Minneapolis police, from the FBI, and even from elected officials in Minnesota. Kenneth described to me how he visited classrooms and schools across the state to scan the faces of the children in the hope that he would spot his sons. The Kleins hired a private investigator whose work demanded hours of their attention. They even consulted with a celebrated psychic horse that directed them, through the interpretations of the horse's owner, to search along a street in St. Paul that had been abandoned for decades. None of this produced worthwhile leads, and the search consumed their lives. But the Kleins never lost hope that they'd see their boys again.
Mom and Dad had their arguments about finances and money, but when it came to the boys, there was never an argument. They were in total agreement. If they thought that they had a good lead or maybe this one would lead to something more, they went. They did it. You know, Dad never gave up hope the whole time he was alive, right to the end. He was hopeful that one of the boys would come back in his lifetime. And my mom, even, you know, and both of them, even when they were here, when a car would go by, Mom would say, I wonder if that's one of the boys. And I lived in Montana, and they loved it, but they wouldn't move out there because what happens if one of the boys comes back? That was one of the reasons they stayed out at the farm so long.
Jim Daniels, Betty Klein's much younger brother, could see how much the Kleins were shaping their lives around their search for the boys. He and others sometimes refer to the boy's father, Kenneth, as Bobby.
It basically was up to Betty and Bobby to do most of the hunting for him. They'd follow up on everything. They went everywhere looking for those boys. You know, every lead that they got, they'd follow up on. Not the police, but her, Betty and Bobby. They spent a lot of money just traveling around looking for them. Every time they would hear a story or see something, they would their hopes would get up. You know, they were just totally not the same. Always thinking about the three boys.
I think the brothers are on their mind constantly during their lives. I remember my mom bought us land up north, up by Crosby. And one of the reasons why Dad and Mom never went up there with us together, one had to stay home, just in case. Of course, we didn't have cell phones, so somebody had to stay home. And that deprived us kids of what little, you know, my dad was 43 years old when I was born, so he wasn't the youngest man in the world. But what little we could have done together, like fishing, where we could have enjoyed it, we didn't get to. So my mom and I went fishing. You know? I think she bought my first shotgun for me and took me, drove me up there to go hunting with it. But again, Dad had to stay home. You know, somebody had to.
And in your childhood memory, what did you imagine happened to them?
I always believed that they were somewhere. They went off to play and somebody got them, you know, but they were being brought up in nice homes and well taken care of. Maybe ended up with a better life than what even we had, you know, better opportunities. Maybe they were taken into a wealthier family or something, you know. I had a lot of time where I've sat and imagined where they were and what they did. That's the whole thing, you know, traveling around the country like I did. I always looked at everybody because you don't know.
When we talked to Gordon, he said something very similar to that, that he too imagined that they were somewhere else and he hoped, you know, leading a good life, and that he always searched people's faces too.
Yeah. I think that was common in our family because we didn't know. It's one thing if you were brought up and you were told, well, your brothers were taken and we think they're gone, you know, we think they were killed. Well, then you wouldn't have a reason to look. Search faces, but you just search for bodies. But Mom and Dad were always optimistic. Mom always said she felt in her heart that they were still alive. Now, you know, I can't argue what she felt.
Hey.
Hi. Good. Good to see you. When I spoke with Gordon, the oldest Klein brother, he was in his backyard, a beautiful spot with apple trees and a sunny patio. The cicadas were buzzing. His four dogs were loping around on the grass, and a gentle breeze blew. The sun dappled the trees as I sat next to him and wondered how to ask him about this cataclysmic event in his family's history and in his own life. All the dogs went inside except for one, who sat at Gordon's side and didn't move away as we talked.
Well, now let's go back in time.
back to 1951, when all this started. What were you like in 1951 as a child, and what kinds of things were on your mind before your brothers disappeared? What kind of kid were you?
Well, we were a really close family. I mean, we were with the brothers and stuff, we were kind of like the gang, you know. We could almost be a baseball team by ourselves, and we played in the street, you know, in front of the house and stuff. Then, of course, cowboys and Indians, and back then, you know, there was no fooling around. When you tied somebody up to the tree, you hit them in the head with the cap gun, you know, and drew blood. That's the only way to do it. It's the way it's the way they did it on the TV, yeah. So.
No fooling around.
Yeah, we didn't fool around either, so. So we were really close. I mean, I don't know what to say. You know, it's just, we were just really close.
What did you like about your neighborhood?
Well, there was a lot of kids in the neighborhood. That was one thing. The neighbors were nice. Of course, they'd holler at us once in a while because we picked their flowers and stuff, you know, so. But they were very nice. Anyway.
Did you feel safe as a kid roaming around the city as you did with your brothers?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had my Uncle Leonard and my Aunt Eva that lived down right close to that area. In fact, right across the street from the Northside Police Station. So, I mean, you should feel pretty safe, you know. We had relatives and then my dad, we went with him all the time because he did a little junking, and so we knew all the people in the steel yards and stuff downtown. So it wasn't a strange place to us. We knew people there and they knew us.
And then the house that you and your family lived in.
Yeah, it was a big two-story house. In fact, it had a full upstairs. You know, some of my aunts and things stayed with us while they worked in Minneapolis and stuff and looked for work. And then it had a full attic. That's where my folks used to hide the presents Christmas time. And we'd have to sneak up and see what's there, so.
You know. You sound like you're very mischievous, all of you.
We were, yeah. We stayed pretty busy.
Mm-hmm. How do you think this experience changed your childhood, changed you?
Oh, looking back on it, I don't think I really had one. You know, because, and I base that on one thing. I didn't have my brothers to have my childhood with. So without them, I look at it as I didn't have one. So, I know that's probably not the way to look at things because I had other things, but it was never the same.
With your parents never giving up,
yep.
Did you feel optimistic that your brothers would be found somehow, somewhere?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I always looked. I was always looking for my brothers. I was sure that, just positive, that somebody took them and sold them and they were with a rich family someplace. I had to look at it like that. So I got her out of a garbage dump down in Texas.
Really?
Yeah. So she is my protector.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was a mess. The vet told me 2 more days she wouldn't have made it.
Wow.
Max, get over here.
Max is like, no.
He's our last rescue. We rescued him too. Everything is a rescue around here.
How did you find out that Deputy Miller was starting to look into things?
She had talked to my mother, and more than anything, Donnie used to call and talk to me about it. because he took care of my mom and dad right up to the end. He was their savior. So, good kid.
Gordy told us that at the end of your parents' lives, that you were assisting them a lot.
Both of them, yeah. No, it was quite an experience. It was a good experience. It was a bad experience, too. It's horrible to watch your loved ones wither and die. That's a horrible experience. And then to have them die unfulfilled. That is not good. You know, I'm glad that Deputy Miller is doing what she's doing, because without it, what would happen? You know, I worry about me dying before the rest of my brothers and not getting something put up. It's not that they're against it, but we're still living in the hope our parents had and handed down to us. We inherited that. That's part of our heritage, our personal heritage.
Even today, the Kleins won't abandon that hope. To them, hope preserves an image of the family that includes the missing brothers. Without that hope, the family picture has big holes. The investigation of deputies Jessica Miller and Lance Saltz has helped keep the hope alive. They brought fresh air and new thinking to a cold case. Working on their own time, they've allowed themselves to be drawn in by the tragedy and mystery of the case and by the sadness of the Klein family. They initially seemed to me like opposites, left brain and right brain. But that turned out to be a crude simplification of what makes them work as partners. As we sit down to talk, it becomes clear almost immediately why their partnership works so well.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Good.
That's great.
Who dressed you today?
Well, apparently you. Is this all being recorded
yep,
right now?
Every single word.
Son of a gun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anything you say can and will be used against you.
Excellent.
How long have the two of you known each other?
Well, you started before I did.
Yeah, I started in 2001.
So it's been about 14 years for me, so about 14 years.
About 14 years. I was working investigations. They were cleaning out old case files. They found a case file that had some bones that were found in Otsego. No answer what happened with those, so it was handed to me because the sergeant who was working at that time, he remembered the Klein case, and he knew they lived in Monticello, and supposedly the boys were said to have drowned in the Mississippi. He didn't know what had happened in the Metro. So when it was handed to me, I was told to look into it. Eventually, we determined the bones were Aboriginal. By that time, I'd already reached out to the Kleins.
But in contacting the family, found out that there was never DNA collected from any of the family members to put into the missing persons database. And so he offered to do that for the family to get that documented. And I am also a member of the Major Crimes Investigation Unit for the department and happened to be working that day. And I went out to collect DNA from Elizabeth Klein. And that's kind of where it started.
When you started in on this 7 or 8 years ago, what did you expect?
At first we didn't know what to expect. It was just kind of learning what was this case about? You know, what information is available? What was done? And is there anything else that could still be done this many years later? And it just kind of ballooned into this project and just kind of led us all over the place. We knew that this isn't a case that we could just professionally, you know, work as part of our jobs. It was something aside from that. And so we came up with the plan that we were going to try to collect as much information as we could, talk to as many people as we could, do what we could, and put it into this package and hopefully pass it off to an entity or agency that could take it and move forward with it if there was something for them to move forward with. That was kind of our goal. So we have now collected DNA from four of the surviving brothers, and then we had Elizabeth's before she passed, and I was able to get an old pair of shoes of Dad, and they got a DNA profile from his shoes. So they're all been entered into the missing persons database. They are officially listed in NCIC as missing persons, as well as NamUs as missing persons.
What is the advantage of having the case listed in these databases?
It preserves it in a way. You know, they're not just, missing boys from 1951. They're now, you know, officially listed. They exist. It's there. That these people, they have a place, you know, in the system per se. So they're preserved there until there's an answer that's found, and it makes the information much more accessible. You know, that somebody who maybe was in the area back then and has moved away and they ever come run across that, maybe they know something that would be helpful. So it kind of just puts the information out there. And if something is found down the line, it traces it back to connect those dots.
As Wright County deputies based in a jurisdiction far from where the boys disappeared, this was as far as Miller and Sauls could take things. But as skilled investigators, curious about why the Minneapolis police couldn't find the boys, and sympathetic to the plight of the Klein family, there was more they could do on their own time. The question was, how?
And this was one of the things that we kind of wrestled over, too. We had to make sure when we were doing this and on our own time that our administration was aware of what we were doing, that it's a second job or something like that, but it is law enforcement related. And as long as we kept it separate from our work, we were fine. It's more like they looked at a sort of an academic study. If it ever crossed a certain line, there could be some real problems. We had to be sure that we could not connect this to our sheriff's office, our employer, just because if something is found later on down the road too, we don't want to be the ones that would cause the problems with the criminal investigation.
How have your colleagues in Wright County viewed your hobby?
Sometimes they think we're nuts because we've been working so long on a case that has such a low probability of being solved just because of the age of it and we don't have a crime scene. We don't have the physical evidence to go with it. And we're relying on a lot of things from old reports and stuff, but also very, very intrigued by it. You know, it's a very interesting case that's gone on for so long. So, they've been very supportive.
How would you describe what the status of the case was before you took it up?
Scattered.
Yeah.
Scattered and just lost everywhere.
A trail of breadcrumbs.
Yeah. And a lot of the stuff that we've gotten, he's been more on the research end, you know, and finding stuff from way back when, you know, spending the time at the Historical Society. And I can't think of a point where we ever really disagreed on anything, but it was more just bouncing things off of each other. You know, what do you think would happen if we, you know, went down this avenue? Or can you think of anything else that we could do here? And we think differently on a lot of that stuff. So I think that's what got us further, is we each had a little bit of a different view on it. And we were able to kind of play off of that and get to where we did. So he's a lot more patient and a lot better at digging that stuff up, the history part of it, than I am. And I'm more on the people side of it. So it actually worked out really well.
I never met Elizabeth. Everything I know about Elizabeth, I learned through Jess. So she's a lot more active than I am as far as the case goes and in the family. Just spent enough time with her and I kind of vicariously through her, I got to know Elizabeth, where you understood where she was coming from. And it was amazing how much effort and energy this person put just to make sure this case would not get lost.
Could you clarify for us what the status of the case is?
I would say the best description of it would be orphaned. The simple fact is that Minneapolis closed this in the 1950s without any compelling evidence by their policy. It's not politics even, it's policy. They can't just reopen it because it falls into Minneapolis PD's jurisdiction.
It happened in Minneapolis, and so it would be a Minneapolis case. It would be under their jurisdiction or the state's jurisdiction. Other than the family moving into Wright County, that's kind of where our connection is. So in order to go about it the right way, it has to be owned, you know, by an agency to go through the right processes. So we've kind of gotten the case open, but we're still pushing for those next steps.
And has that been difficult up to this point?
Yeah, in some ways it has been. It's a difficult case. There's not any physical evidence or scene, you know, to kind of go on. So you have to rely on these reports and this information that's been collected over the last 67 years. So it requires time, which is hard to give. So it's a difficult thing to kind of get to the top of the list of things to do. And I think we'll get there with our persistence. It's just going to take some time.
How would you describe your connection with the living brothers?
They've kind of adopted us in a way, I think. They're so grateful for the time that we spend on this, and they're so helpful with everything. You know, if I call them and I need something or I have a question about something, they're on it immediately. I mean, they're right back to me. They're so willing to help. I mean, even through all of these years and all the frustrations of everything and the stalling out of the case and the dead ends that we've come up with, they're very persistent. And they've all been really great to work with.
I thank God for her, you know, because she jumped on it and she went with it and she took care of it.
Were you present when Deputy Miller first met with your mother?
I believe I was, yes.
Do you remember anything about that meeting?
Mom was very happy that somebody was taking interest in it. But Mom was also a little confused because here's somebody going to work on it that's in law enforcement from Wright County in her off-duty time. And it's under Minneapolis police jurisdiction. They wanted nothing to do with it. So Mom was a little confused by that, but she was very happy, and her and Jessica got along very well. You know, Jessica's a very nice person. She's a easy person to talk to. She's got a great personality, and she's right down to earth. You don't feel intimidated. You know she's a deputy, but she doesn't stand there like she's got to wait and whack you with that deputy. I have a lot of respect for her.
It's one of those cases, I think, that you have more of a personal connection with. You know, it's something that we do on our own time, and being involved in the case for this long and you get to know the family and have those connections with them, it carries a lot of weight with you. It's a responsibility. With that, I guess it's persistence does pay off. And if you think that you're finished with something, you may not be. We've run into that several times with this case. We think we're at the end. And, you know, a couple of months later, something new pops up. And then just being encouraged by a case this old, then we've been able to find so much on. So it is possible. And maybe at some point we will have collected all enough pieces of the puzzle to put it together and get an answer for this family.
This is a case with huge gaps. There's no extant physical evidence. Many people involved are now dead, and nearly 70 years have passed. One person made it possible for Jessica and Lance to keep this case alive.
Finding Sergeant Schultz. Sergeant Schultz, he's retired Minneapolis Parks Police, and he had worked the case for quite some time, interviewed family members and old officers that were working those beats during that time that we don't have the opportunity to do today. And he preserved all of that. And so in finding him, you know, and my partner Lance had met with him, and he said, you know, I've been waiting years for somebody to call me and ask about this case. Here you go. You know, so, I mean, that just opened up a whole new avenue of information and stuff that we never would have gotten had we not found him and had he not done that work back in the 90s.
Hi, Jim. I'm Jack.
How you doing, Jack?
Very nice to meet you. And thanks so much for coming here for this.
You're welcome.
How do you feel about talking about all this? And
well, I've never been interviewed before.
Yeah.
So in the police work, I've never been on TV. Mm-hmm. I'm doing it as a favor for you.
Thank you.
And I hope you're successful at what you want to do.
Sergeant Schultz is a complex person. Now retired from police work, he looks at you and speaks with intensity, as if he's sizing you up as a suspect of some kind. His manner is guarded, but he still wanted to share his strong feelings about the case.
My name is Jim Schultz, and I work for the Minneapolis Park Police. I worked there, I think, 24 years, 5 years on patrol and 19 years in investigation.
It was a local news story in the 1990s that first brought the case to Sergeant Schultz's attention. But it was his work as a park police officer that spurred him to look more deeply at the story and its connection to Farview Park.
I saw an injustice to the fact in a bad conclusion that the boys drowned. My knowledge was that if a person drowns, the body surfaces. Three people drowned and no body surfaces. Add to that the fact that now they're not all 8 years old. There's a 4-year-old, a 6-year-old, and an 8-year-old, all different heights, different weights. All three bodies should have come up if they were in the river.
In your experience, how unusual is this case in the sense that three children are missing, never found, never seen again? Police have come to a conclusion which makes them close the case, but then the family keeps looking.
It's highly unusual. I think the family is hoping somebody else will look. And it's unusual that three children disappear, and the conclusion made by the police is faulty. We know they were not in the river. At least I know. I've come to the conclusion I am 100% certain they're not in the river. I bet my house on it. It's highly unusual police would make that grievous a mistake. If it happened today, they would not close this case for 20 years. They keep looking.
When I first covered this case in 1998, the mystery of what happened to the boys was vast. The central question was, if they didn't drown in the river, then what? Jessica and Lance, with the work done by Jim Schultz, have focused that question into a series of possible answers. And for the first time in almost 70 years, there is a list of suspects in the case of the missing Klein brothers.
On the next episode of Long Lost.
One of the great things you were able to do is develop a list of suspects, which hadn't happened before.
Yeah, we have quite a list of suspects. It's hard to rule people out at this point.
Of course, I interviewed the parents. It's pretty standard that, well, maybe the parents were responsible or knew something they hadn't told the police yet.
I've always kind of thought it was somebody that worked at Fairview Park that was involved in it.
Both our number one and number two suspects knew the boys. They were around in that area. They would have been people that they would have been used to seeing. And probably had some trust in, and so could have gone off with them somewhere.
Long Lost is a production of Twin Cities PBS, written by Jack L. High and produced by Katie O'Rourke. Original music by Robert L. High. Audio engineering by Terry Gray. Additional sound by Eric Poggle, Joe Demko, and Johnny Hagen. Managing Director Brendan Heenahan. Executive Producer Daniel Pierce Bergen. Production Manager Ted Hink and Production Coordinator Ann Guttridge. Special thanks to the Minnesota Historical Society and KSTP Archives, and the University of Minnesota Press, publisher of Jack L. High's new book about the Klein case, The Lost Brothers. Funding for this podcast was made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and Friends of Minnesota Experience. You can reach us at longlost@tpt.org and visit us at tptoriginals.org/longlost to learn more about the case.